At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Off the ball, breakfast.
Fairly extraordinary feeling. Just stood up and I just stood there in silence for a couple of minutes. I actually could not believe what I just seen. It was absolutely remarkable.
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.
Now then, you're very welcome back. Blonid Riley is our guest in studio. And I should just say at the outset that the conversation comes with a significant warning. If you are in the slightest bit triggered by conversations around sexual violence, then this may not be for you, or certainly do proceed with caution. Now, we have no intention of getting overly graphic, of course, but the themes are clearly very heavy and very difficult. And equally, if you're in the car or the kitchen with children, I would suggest probably a pass until maybe 9 o'clock or so. Although keep listening if you can, because I dare say it's part of Blonid's motivation in being here that you might have meaningful conversation with your kids in the years to come around the areas of consent and beyond. I suspect you have seen Blonid's story in recent months. She very bravely waived her right to anonymity and spoke publicly about her ordeal. In 2019, she was the victim of rape on a night out in Galway. The rapist, now serving an 8-year custodial term, Jonathan Moran, is from Mullingar, same town as Blonid. They just happened to be both out in Galway on that night. Blonid, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me.
No, it's great to have you here in the studio. Just to say, and I said it to you in advance, but just so listeners know, this is very much a recorded interview. If there is anything at the end of this you want out, by all means, just say this interview is very much on your terms. And so I'll follow your lead a little bit. Horrific attack in July of 2019. You're just at the end of a legal case. So 5 years.
Yeah.
It's your 20s and counting, really.
Yeah.
And then you waived your right to privacy and anonymity and you went public and you've done several interviews, which is a big thing to do. There's been a lot to process. I know you've had maybe a few weeks of relative calm.
Yeah.
So how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Good. It's been a whirlwind, probably more than I ever expected. Probably went bigger than I thought. I reached a lot more people than I thought I'd ever get the opportunity to, which has been massive. But yeah, it's been nice to have a little bit of a come down and, you know, kind of get back to normal life, figure out kind of the new normal life for me post trial and all that kind of stuff.
How early on do you make a decision to go public, for instance?
You don't make an official decision until the day of your sentencing, or the day of your attacker's sentencing. So it's not really even a conversation they have with you until that's kind of all done and dusted. But I kind of knew. I always had that in my head when the DPP decided to bring charges against Johnny Moore. And I said, if I get a guilty verdict here, I'm going to waive my right to anonymity. It was just something that I felt I could do and I kind of wanted to do. I know I've said it very kind of openly, but in the whole trial process and the whole sort of healing process throughout all of this, when I'd be triggered by stuff or anything like that, my sleep would be the first thing to kind of take the hit, and I'd be up all night and reading cases, probably to sort of anticipate what I was in for and what was coming, you know. And I'd read cases, but I never could, you know, nobody ever resonated with me. I could never see similarities or say, you know, like that girl has a similar lifestyle or looks like me or, you know, it's the same age or whatever. I found a lot of the people whose names and faces were out there were kind of more historical cases. So I thought if I can get a guilty verdict and I can share it, it might just offer some comfort to other people going through a similar process.
And are you glad you did it?
Yeah, I am glad. I think it's brought a lot of healing to my own kind of journey, I suppose. Sounds very metaphoric, but yeah, I do think it's helped me a lot and probably has brought to my attention that, like, people don't realise the severity of these cases or what's involved in these cases until people share what has happened and the process and all of that. People are sort of unaware of how these things work. So I think in that sense, it's helped a lot of people close to me and just people who don't know me sort of understand the process that I've gone through and my family have gone through over the last few years.
Anyone who followed the case will have a sense of your life before the night of the attack in July 2019 from Mullingar, college, yeah. Relatively carefree. That'd be the broad summary.
Yeah, definitely. I always, you know, describe it as like your typical 21-year-old, couldn't give a damn about anything, didn't know, you know, what she was doing with her life. I was just kind of tipping away at college, coming home at the weekends, going out, very, very normal things that lots of people do.
Tipping away sounds like a bit of a euphemism.
Just the bare minimum, yeah. Probably.
So life was pretty good.
Yeah.
In so much as you're comfortable, tell us about the night. I know you've been asked that question a lot in recent interviews, so it's clearly a serious undertaking to ask you that question. But tell us about the night in so much as you're comfortable.
So I decided to go on a night out with one of my friends. She lived two doors down the road. And we said we'd go out, kind of, we're hemming and hawing about where we'd go, what we'd do. We said, oh, we're fed up going to Mullingar.
Right.
So it was the same. We talked to the same people, have the same conversations. So the arts festival was on in Galway. So we said we'd head up for the night. It's only about an hour and 20 minutes from home. So we got ready and headed out. I had a friend who lived up there for college. So I texted him on the way, said, can we stay with you? He said, yeah. So he sent me his like street address, literally parked the car, got a taxi into Ayr Square, down Shop Street into one of the pubs and then another pub. And again, like I said, I was very typical 21-year-old. Our night was a very typical night. A few drinks, nothing major. Mm. Chatting away. Then there was another group of guys there and we recognised some of them from Mullingar. And Johnny Morn was in this group. So my friend who lived in Galway had played rugby with him. I would have recognised him from the local rugby club, Mullingar Rugby Club, where my brothers had played. Sort of just knew of him, similar age, not friends, never really had much interaction with him, but knew who he was, knew him and his brother. They were there with a group of friends. So kind of mutual friends, you know, you get chatting or whatever. There was a whole big group. People were kind of in and out of a smoking area, that sort of thing. And sort of as the night went on, people started to like fall off. So my friend who was living in Galway, his girlfriend got quite drunk. He had to bring her home. And the girl I had travelled up with had met somebody she had gone to her deb's with, you know, the typical things, and was off with him. And she texted me and she was like, oh, I might head on home. And I was like, yeah, yeah, grand. I wasn't too concerned. I was very comfortable in the situation, having a chat with all different people. Yeah. And then the night kind of was coming to an end. And I remember thinking, how am I going to get home? Like, I don't really know where I'm staying or whatever. And my parents always said, never get into a taxi on your own. It was just a fear there, something I think they grew up with, you know. And I thought, like, oh, God. And I was standing talking to Johnny and his brother, and Johnny said, well, we're having a bit of a party back at the house. It's nothing major now. You're more than welcome to come. It'll just be a couch, but you're, you know. And I thought, all right, well, I know these people. It's kind of safest option, you know. When you're on a night out as well, you just think, oh, I don't want this to end, this is good fun. So a group of us headed back. There was a bit of a party, not like maybe 12-14 people in the house.
A very comfortable number.
Yeah, just sitting around chatting, the mixture between boys and girls, you know, the usual. There was a box of cans, like it was very relaxed affair. And slowly just people started to filter off, you know, go to bed or whatever. And by the end of the night, then by the time the last person kind of left, the bedrooms were all upstairs. It was just the kitchen, living room, downstairs. And all was fine. And then Johnny got up and turned off the light in the living room. And it was just like, with that flick of a switch, he just changed. He just went from this person who was chatty and very normal, talked about my brothers, talked about the rugby season and, you know, like all those normal sorts of things, to somebody who was just so hostile and just changed, barely spoke. When he spoke, it was all very instructional, you know, demands, what he wanted. So the assault started in the house. And I kind of thought, right, I need to get out of here. What am I going to do? Mm. Don't quite know where I'm going. I need to calm this down a bit. And even though an assault had taken place at that stage, I never anticipated what was going to come. I never feared what was going to come. I thought, if anything, he's going to hit me or punch me, or, you know, because he seemed angry that I wasn't playing ball, but it wasn't. I just thought, oh, he's, you know. So he said, do you want to come out for a cigarette? And I thought, okay, this might calm the whole situation down a little bit. So we went out to the garden, and that's then where the shed kind of, that bit happened. And I won't go into too much detail there because it's quite graphic, but it was a locked shed, pitch black, a very tight space, and it didn't go on for very long, maybe 10 minutes altogether in the shed. And luckily, two people from the house, from the party, came downstairs for a cigarette and gave me the opportunity to knock and get out, which then led to me being able to get out of the house like minutes later.
And did those two people recognise that something very unusual has happened?
No. So they gave evidence in the trial and they were able to kind of, you know, back my story up, in the sense of when I came out, I just got an air of calmness about me. So I just walked into the house and very calm. I didn't say anything at that point. And I went to the bathroom, and I then at that stage saw that I was bleeding and that I, you know, had some injuries and stuff. And I thought, I need to get out of here. And I went downstairs and picked up my handbag and my shoes. I didn't even put them on. And at that stage, I was upset. And they kind of looked, but nobody said anything. And I left the house at, I think, 5:10 right. that morning.
And did he say anything when you came down, or was he in the
No, vicinity? he was sitting on a couch. And he sat with his eyes closed. And as I picked my handbag up from the couch, he opened his eyes and kind of looked out the side and just stared at me and then closed them again. Never spoke, nothing. Could see I was upset, obviously. He knew what had happened, but yet never spoke, nothing.
You shut the front door behind you and you're in Galway at 5:10 in the morning.
Yeah.
Unbelievably upset and probably not too sure where you are or what to do.
Yeah, so I knew Galway, but I didn't know it like very well. So I left and I was like on a cul-de-sac of houses, and I just thought, oh, I need to get out of here, like, you know. And I suppose when something like that happens, it's adrenaline too. I didn't fully think to myself, I've just been raped. You know, I just thought, I need to, I suppose, a safety thing. I just need to get out of here. Mm. So I rang my boyfriend at the time, and I was like crying down the phone, but I never spoke, never actually told him at that stage what had happened. So I just stayed walking, and I ended up kind of coming back to an area that was quite built up, and there was a casino. There's people coming out of the casino, and this girl spotted me and spotted how upset I was. And she was like, oh, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I just can't find my friends. And she's like, oh, we'll find them. And, you know, she wasn't too concerned. And but I just kept getting more and more upset. And there was a guy in her group of friends, and he just kept saying, there's something not right about this girl. Like, she's way too upset for what she's saying. And he just kept pushing, can I bring you to the guards? Can I bring you to the guards? They'll be able to, you know, find your friends, get you back home. And, like, thankfully for that guy, I never got his name. I don't know who he is, but thank God for him, because I went to the guards that morning. I think I arrived into them at 6:00 or something, and they were able to get me to the sexual assault treatment unit by 9 o'clock that morning, get an initial statement. That probably luckily in a sense that I did know who the attacker was because I could name him and I could give a description of him. I didn't know where the house was, so they put me into the back of the squad car and we drove around Galway until something looked familiar and we could backtrack and we found the house that way. So they brought me to the treatment unit and at that stage they got into the house at 9 o'clock that morning. Yeah, so that all happened so quick and thankfully because of that stranger, you know, on the street.
He must really have sensed the full, or if not, maybe not quite the full, but he must have had a sense of what had happened
because
nobody needs the guards to find their friends.
Yeah, exactly. And he just kept pushing, you know, think you need the guards, you know, we can't drive you now or we can't help you, you know. And he just knew that something wasn't adding up with how upset I was and what I was saying. It just didn't add up.
Yeah. And so I presume without the speed of your treatment and I presume some kind of an examination of what is a crime scene.
Yeah.
The conviction is very, very difficult.
Yeah. And I was always so thankful the whole way through. I always said, thank God, because I kind of presumed because I had gone straight away. There was DNA evidence. There was all of that. And I had known straight away that the bottle that was used in the attack, that they had that, because that was a major thing for me. I needed that to be proven that he had did that. And so I knew they had those. And I kept saying, well, thank God for that, because how is he going to argue this? You know, like, how is he going to argue this in court? Little did I know he actually didn't have to argue that in court. The accused doesn't take the stand, doesn't give any evidence. So he actually sat in silence. But what he did do was give an interview to the guards when he was arrested, which tripped him up massively. You know, he denied all of this stuff. And they had the evidence, you know, to disprove him. Like he said, I didn't leave the house until 9 o'clock that morning. I was in with the guards at 6. You know, there was lots and lots of different things that he had said that were just so easily disproven. But yeah, that forensic, and I always hung on to that and I always said, oh, I don't know, could I go through a trial if I didn't have that evidence or whatever? But the judge did make a comment in my trial that even without that concrete evidence, he reckoned there could have been a conviction. Mm. So, you know, that's probably a comfort to people who mightn't have all of that concrete evidence that there are ways of catching people out and these offenders do very silly things.
When you're trying to talk to the guards at 6 a.m. and you're so upset and you probably still haven't even begun to process what's happened, can you even get the words out? Like, I mean, I can't imagine that interview process at all.
And it's actually a really strange one because you feel you don't really even understand what has happened to you, in the sense of I just kept saying I was assaulted. You know, there was an incident. Mm. I didn't use the word rape. I nearly felt guilty, or, you know, like I didn't have the right to say that that's what had happened. And I didn't want to put words in their mouth either for me to say what had happened and the guard say, no, that's not what that is. Do you know?
Yes.
Not that there wasn't any sign of them saying anything like that, but it is. And they're so good at what they do and the questions they ask. And, you know, they know their priorities. They know what they need to get and what they're trying to do. But yeah, it is. It hasn't even begun to sink in what has happened.
What are the days and weeks like afterwards, that immediate period?
I mean, that immediate period is really strange because, again, it hasn't sunk in what has actually happened. And I suppose adrenaline keeps you going and it doesn't really hit you. I just kept saying, I'm fine. This is going to be fine. It's nothing to worry about. When I rang my parents that morning to tell them what had happened, again, I said, I've been assaulted. There's been an incident. I didn't tell them who it was. I didn't want to tell my dad because I just knew that it would be so hard on him.
Yeah.
Didn't want my brothers to know who it was because they knew him. So it was all very much like, we're just going to keep going with this now. I'm just going to put my head down and life's going to be normal. But then all of a sudden, these little things start to creep in that you go, oh, my life isn't what it was. You know, my mom brought me to a shopping centre one day and I got the smell of aftershave for the first time since the attack, and I ended up, you know, vomiting. And then all these little things start creeping in, and slowly but surely just takes over your life, and the life you lived is gone, and you're grieving that life. You're grieving all the things you used to do. You're grieving the person you were before it, and you're met with this fear, this wave of shock of what has happened. You know, so you're kind of going between the two and fighting so hard just for normality, to try and do the normal things that you've done that aren't things you enjoy anymore, you know, and they're not, it's not there anymore. And then facing into a trial, like, when is it going to happen? What's the next step, you know? So it's a really strange time, that immediate aftermath.
Yeah. And do you go into counselling straight away?
Yeah. So I did. I went, I think, the week after I started to attend the Rape Crisis Centre in Tullamore. And I attended them for like the 5 years between the attack and the trial. And I will continue to use them in the future. You know, I don't use them as frequently anymore, but there's definitely times where I need it and I go back and I do a few sessions and then I'm good again. And I, you know, I stay going for another few months and then I might check back in. And but counselling is massive. Because you don't know what's happening in your head and in your body. It's a whole, you know, foreign thing. And your family don't really know what's going on. And it's a whirlwind for them. So it's very hard for anyone really to support you. But they're the professionals. They know what to say and what to do.
And what are the more common emotions that you feel over the last 5 years?
Probably sadness is the biggest one. I feel very sad that this is my life, and this is my life because of a choice that somebody has made. Sometimes I'd love to be able to say, oh, I feel so angry, and sometimes I do, but it's not the strongest emotion. I do, I feel sad that, and like I said, it's like a grief nearly. I grieve the old me. I grieve the person who was carefree, the person who didn't, you know, look behind them every time they turn a corner, or, you know, I can't let anybody walk behind me on a staircase now. And I do, I grieve that, like, old person who had so much ahead of them and didn't have this roadblock or this anchor to drag along with me. So I definitely think a sadness in me that does, you know, get better, but it's always kind of there. Even after the trial, I had this realization that, oh, I got a guilty verdict, but the sadness isn't gone. You know, still somebody made a choice to hurt me and they didn't care, you know, and they saw a weakness or an opportunity to hurt me and didn't value me or what it would do to me at all.
Mm.
You know, and that's a kind of a bitter pill to swallow, because you think, oh, he does 8 years, but I have the rest of my life with that.
Yeah. Well, trust me, so does he.
Yeah.
Are you optimistic about your life?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I am.
I'm not robbed you of that then.
No. I think there's lots in life for me to do. I think maybe, you know, okay, what I just said was very, you know, pessimistic, but there has been really happy times in the last 5 years. And I think this whole process has shown me probably a side to me that I didn't know was there, a fight in me that I probably didn't realise was there. And a passion now for trying to do some good for other people who might be going through this, or that might trying to prevent this happening to other people. I suppose a passion for that wouldn't have been there without it. and an opportunity maybe to delve into that that I didn't realise was there, but it is now. And I do feel optimistic about that. And I just want a simple life, really. Nothing mad, nothing crazy. Don't have mad career goals or anything like that. Just simple and just basic happiness, really. Yeah.
Are there tools that you've picked up with the counselling that have been useful?
Yeah. So I probably have a few things that I lean on massively. Horses is a big one for me, and I've spoken about that. That's my big grow in life is horses. And the whole way through, the horses have kept me going when nothing else could make me do anything with my day, or I was so upset. The horses had to be fed, or they had to be ridden, or they had to, you know, be looked after. And that would get me to do a little bit each day, and that would grow, and, you know,
yes, okay.
I did more and more.
And they're so beautiful.
Yeah, and they're so therapeutic.
Yeah.
If animals is something, if you're an animal person, they're just so therapeutic, even being around them, brushing them, talking to them, you know, it is so therapeutic. And then in recent, probably in the last year or so, I got into boxing, like non-contact boxing now. Not going fighting anyone. I'm not taking over Kelly Harrington or anything. And I do that in Heden Boxing Academy. They have gyms around Dublin, and I have found that brilliant. Probably for an aspect of safety, I feel a little bit more safe. Not that I think I'd ever use it, but it's there. If, you know, it's a comfort. With the counselling, probably just doing little things at a time. I think people get caught up when somebody's struggling. You know, your support network might be all gung-ho, you know, Irish people and Irish women in particular are very fixers, you know, like, what can we do to fix this? And sometimes in these processes, there is no fixing it. You just need time to be with it and get through it and kind of process it. And I think that's something I've learned with the counselling, is sometimes when it hits, a lot of the processes, I get a trigger, something triggers, and my whole response and nervous system goes into high alert, and I need to think about it, and I need to have a cry, and then it'll all come down.
Okay.
And it's just knowing that process, I suppose, and riding the wave a little bit. In time, I've kind of learned the pattern of it, and I can ride the wave. But yeah, sometimes I think, and somebody, I think in these cases, people think, oh, she's fine, I won't bring it up, I don't want to trigger her, I don't want to upset her. And sometimes all you want is for somebody to talk to you about it,
right,
and to bring it up and ask you, how are you? And, you know,
not make it a taboo situation when it's your life.
Which happens quite a lot. You know, people think, oh, she's doing great now, I'm not going to bring it up. And sometimes it's the most healing thing for somebody to be like, you know, and how are you? Or, yeah, that is rubbish. Sometimes you just need somebody to say, that's rubbish. That is annoying, you know, like,
I don't have a solution for
you. Yeah. And you don't always want a solution, because sometimes, you know, there is no solution, but just acknowledge it is rubbish.
Everyone's experience, I'm sure, is so different in this realm. We had a former guest in the show I spoke to a couple of years ago who was abused as a child by a swimming coach. Famous case, I'm sure you're familiar with it. And I always remember her saying, listen, no offence to any of your listeners, but I will never trust a man again. There is just forever a layer of unease around all men, and that's just the way it is. And I found that totally understandable.
Well, yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned difficult, somebody walking behind you in the stairs, for instance.
Yeah.
In terms of, I don't know, trusting men at large, being out in a pub environment again, like, all of that stuff. Is that terribly difficult, or where are you in that?
It is difficult. I'm probably lucky I don't have that sense of I can never trust a man again, because I have so many healthy relationships with men, you know, in my life. But, and that's not to, you know, everybody, again, deals with these things differently. A pub environment, definitely, I do find difficult. I find if I go to a pub, I won't have a drink. I'll drive so I can get out of there. Things like that, are difficult. I don't have that. I don't trust any man again, thankfully.
Yeah.
But I can understand it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And I guess, is that, it's interesting, maybe when you talked earlier about the grief for life you had, life you could have, I suppose something as simple as well, I'll drive to the pub and I won't have a drink.
Yeah.
That's a little bit of the experience, normal experience that you've kind of cashed in as part of this process. And I'm sure there's dozens of those.
And that's probably something that I find really hard to get the message across about, but is something that's so strong to me is the effects of this on people. Like things that you would never even realise, like showering, a really basic daily task for a victim of sexual violence, can be one of the hardest things. For me, pre-assault, I loved buying clothes and was so into like my makeup and all of that. And in the aftermath, I just felt like my body wasn't worth anything nice. It had allowed this happen to me and it didn't deserve anything. And, you know, for a young girl or guy, whatever, you know, it's taken a part of your identity away, and it's taken something that you loved away. And that's the thing with sexual violence. So much is taken from you. Your control is taken from you, but then all these little bits of your personality is just taken.
Yes. Oh, look, it's vacuous and childish, but getting dressed up in your 20s is half the fun. You know?
Yeah. And going out and not being worried and not thinking, you know, oh, I can't drink now because I want to be able to leave whenever I want to, you know. And that's the kind of the sad thing. Like I'm only 26 now, and to even think like that, I think is, you know, I probably still should be carefree to a point. We all have to be responsible for ourselves.
Sure.
But, you know, like, yeah. And I think I've missed out on that chunk.
How have your family come through it all?
They're brilliant. I suppose the process of the trial and kind of in the aftermath, like up until very recently, I probably didn't realise the effects it had as much on my family of two older brothers and my mum and dad. And it, like, only recently I heard my brother talk about he'd never live in Mullingar again, and his struggle to trust people in the aftermath, which I found really interesting. Because he knew my attacker, he played rugby with my attacker, and he talked about how he really struggles to trust people now because it was somebody he knew, and he holds an element of responsibility in that, you know, like if he knew that's how he made me comfortable was his connection to my brothers, and that's something that's quite heavy for them to carry, and I know the two boys especially struggle with it. With the whole lot, but they went through the whole trial with me and the sentencing and everything, and they've been just so amazing and the best support network, and we're so close because of it. But I think that's something that doesn't get talked about as much, the effects on a family and how it just crushes a family really. And you're very isolated, because people can't empathize really. They do try, but it's not a feeling they understand, you know. And I suppose you get into a very protective mode then as well, but it's definitely been really tough on them.
I can only imagine. And an aspect of this case obviously is that Jonathan Moran had his night in Galway and then continued life, you know. And for 5 years in effect, so he continued in his job, he continued to live in the same town as you, he continued to play for the local rugby club, Mullingar Rugby Club. Your brothers, for various reasons, said, well, we can't continue to be a teammate of this guy, and so they had to leave, which I know was difficult for the family. And I guess every time you summoned the bravery to leave your house, there was the possibility you were going to see him.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other world of pain on top of the pain.
Yeah, that was one of the really hard things. I was like salt in the wound because I was so kind of not myself and was living really in the shadows of life. Like I wasn't engaging in life really. It was really just in the very high levels of trauma at that stage. Yeah, I always had that fear of seeing him, and I avoided Mullingar, and I did see him on two occasions and he just didn't bother him at all. Now I didn't approach him or I didn't speak to him, but he knew I was there and he wasn't leaving. But he continued a very normal life. Like he worked until the day he was taken into custody. His workplace knew nothing about it. He didn't inform anybody. He really just pulled up the shutters and just went into a state of denial. He played rugby up until the end of this season and ended up playing against one of my brothers. No problem. Didn't bother him. He went out and played a full match, and he wasn't going to sit it out, you know, which is very hard when nobody else knows. And my brother's there on the pitch and he can't react and he can't jeopardise anything.
Yeah.
And that's a bitter pill to swallow, that somebody's life can continue to be totally normal when yours is in rubble.
Your brother's teammates probably said, thanks for joining our local rivals.
Yeah.
Well, I thought we
yeah, were, exactly. Yeah. You know, like small town kind of syndrome in a sense, like, oh, you think you're better than us and and all this kind of stuff. And that's the hard part about that too, is in the aftermath, there has been nothing from any of those people to say, oh my God, I'm so sorry that we didn't realise.
I thought there'd be a queue at the door. No?
Yeah, not a peep from anybody to say, Jesus Christ, I can't believe what has happened. We're disgusted, nothing. You know, even not for me, if they didn't know me on a personal level, that's fine. But, you know, Dermot played with them for years and like nothing, not an acknowledgement of, Jesus Christ, we're so sorry.
Because I saw Mullingar Rugby Club released a statement around the time of the sentencing.
Yeah.
To the extent that they were deeply shocked and saddened.
Yeah. So they released a statement to the media. They didn't release a statement on any of their own public platforms or anything like that, but just to the media to say that they were shocked that he had been expelled in light of the sentencing or whatever, and that it was striving to create a very inclusive environment and all of that kind of stuff. That statement went out, and the next day my brother had to ask them to remove photos of Johnny Moran celebrating his 100 caps off their social media. So, yeah, it was kind of a hard time for me. I had a lot of sadness and anger really towards them, because the comfort I had the whole way through when he would play and I'd see these pictures of him up on social media playing and him being celebrated was, when they find out, they're going to be horrified. When they find out, they're going to be so sorry. But I didn't get that. And that was really disappointing. And I don't really know why. I don't know. Was it an awkwardness? I don't know. Yeah.
The wheels of justice turn slowly.
Yeah.
So COVID happens. That doesn't help.
No.
It's a continual complaint of everybody just how slow the process is, how difficult the process is. Yeah. I mean, I suspect even people in the Department of Justice and beyond would agree and would love to speed things up. And yet it's what, like lack of judges sometimes, or lack just everything takes forever.
Everything just seems to take forever. There is an extent where they're gathering evidence and stuff like that, and you're waiting on stuff to come back. And then it goes to the DPP and they decide whether there's sufficient evidence, if they're going to take a case or whatever. And then it kind of has to go through a number of steps, but it's so slow when it gets to that stage of going through those steps. It's really slow.
And you can sort of get it, because the stakes are so high and there has to be precision and every box checked and double checked. But in terms of a percentage of your 26 years, 5 years,
it's a lot.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
And is your life on
hold?
Is it? Yeah. Okay.
Like you're getting by day to day, but like any big plans or anything, you just put them on hold. Like changing job or going to do my master's or anything like that, it was always when the trial is over.
Okay, so that when the trial was over was almost probably a mantra.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and for everyone, like in my family, was, oh, such thing is on in April. Oh no, we can't do April. The trial is on in April.
Yes.
Then you get there and you get a call on the day to say, we don't have enough judges. Sorry. Could be next year. Chat to you later. And you are so built up for this trial, and then it's ripped from you.
Right.
And you're flattened again, and it's every little, you build yourself up and then you're knocked back down. And every time it just takes that little bit more to build yourself back up. And you get to the point And you think, why am I doing this? What's the point? What's the point? I'm just putting myself through torture.
Mm.
And like, I mightn't even get a guilty verdict. I'm putting myself through all of this and it might be for nothing.
Mm.
You know, and that's really the thought process you have. I mightn't even be believed.
Yeah. And you kept it very tight in Mullingar. It wasn't like the whole town knew the situation.
No.
So, I mean, that's even a big thing to carry.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Usually we have to chase guests to come on the show. They generally say no and we have to go and chase others. The interesting thing here is you reached out to us, which, we're privileged and thrilled to have you. So why did you do that? I know raising awareness that you're predominantly a male audience listening, I'm sure, without being cliched about things. And
so that was something that caught my attention. In the aftermath of all of this, I kind of was just, it was highlighted to me in the responses and stuff I got on online and stuff like that, that it was like 95% women that had contacted me. And I had like thousands of messages from people, but there was like so little women or so little men and even less like younger men. It was all maybe like older men, you know, that might be grandfathers or fathers or whatever. And they could empathize and they could. But there was just this silence from a younger male demographic. And then I married that up with the statistics of, you know, likely offenders, and the age demographic of likely offenders is that younger male demographic. We're seeing that now, that under the age of 35, there's such a high level of offending in sexual violence in that age group. And I just thought, there's something not adding up here, you know, like, why can't we, that younger demographic, stand up against this and say, I don't agree with this. And I did a fundraiser for Tullamore and Dublin Rape Crisis Centre and I got a huge response to it. And I had shared it with influencers and all of that. And I had so many share it. And you could see when an influencer would share it, the total would just fly up. And I was trying to get male influencers to share it and male role models. And I just couldn't. I just wouldn't hear back from them, or they wouldn't share it. And I thought, this is really like strange. And I didn't take it personally. It wasn't anything like that. But I just thought, as a societal thing, it was really interesting. And that's, I suppose, why I wanted to be able to share, I suppose, the reality of this to a younger male audience. I just thought it was a really good opportunity to maybe make them aware. I thought, maybe they're not aware. Maybe they're not accessing media in the same way that other people are, or whatever. And, you know, and it's not a case of all men are bad and all men do this. And that's not, nobody's saying that. And I'm certainly not saying that. But I do think there's opportunities there for men to do loads, really positive things to stop this happening, because it's happening so much. Like, I wish people could see into the victim support suites in the Central Criminal Court, because it is just full of sexual violence and rape cases. And for every case, that is somebody's life shattered.
Yeah.
And they're only the cases that are making it to there. You know, there's cases that don't have sufficient evidence. There's cases that are never reported. And their life is equally as shattered as mine, you know. Just because I got a guilty verdict doesn't give me any more validation than anybody else. But I just thought there was a real opportunity for a group to kind of look and say, oh, we could do more here, you know, to make things safer for people when they're out. And, you know, I know I've spoken about my thoughts on education for people. I have looked into, you know, once we leave school at the age of 18, for most of us, that's where our education on consent ends. And that is not where our sexually active life ends. And I think there's, you know, a lot of, I know we had the conversation beforehand, there's a lot of grey areas around consent, and people mightn't be aware that they're actually having non-consensual sex. It mightn't be in it, that they intend on it, yes. that it's an intentional thing, but it can happen. And, you know, that's a dangerous place to be.
It is. We were chatting briefly before we came on air, and I was making the point that in your instance, I mean, God, where do you start if that person doesn't realise that that's wrong?
Yeah. But
there is this then huge grey area.
Yeah. Massively. And we're like, alcohol is involved and all of that kind of thing. And I just thought, there's a massive gap there. You know, you're educated at the age of 16 and 17 and then you're let off into the world.
Yeah.
And consent is changing all of the time, and the law around consent is changing all the time. And I think there's a massive gap, and it's actually very hard to access education on consent and also to have a conversation about it, you know. And I have an idea where sporting organisations get on board and help educate their members, not only to educate people maybe on consent in their own sexual interactions, but if you're out with a group of friends and you see something happening and you're wondering, is that consensual? Is it not? Is it, you know, that you know? And, you know, that I think is an important thing, and that we can all kind of conduct ourselves and all hold a responsibility. Some of the thing I got back from the sporting organisations when I kind of pitched this was, it's not our responsibility. It's not our responsibility to educate members. It's not our responsibility. They're coming to play sport. And I just think, for the amount of sexual violence that's happening in the country, something needs to be done. And yeah, it has to be done from a lot of different approaches. It has to be done from the Department of Justice. It has to be done in our schools. It has to be done in all of the maybe workplaces. But what an opportunity to have groups of people together and be able to educate them in the masses. And also not only educate them, but start a conversation and start maybe a little bit of a cultural change, that if somebody says something, that you kind of pick them up on it. You know, this locker room talk, and we hear about this so often, and you think, oh, it's harmless. But it might be harmless for you and me, who would never have any intention of doing that. But for somebody who might be, you know, a likely perpetrator, every time they hear these comments that are accepted, all of that, it's always desensitizing their brain, and it's adding, you know, to their ego, and that they think, well, I can do this because Jimmy says loads of things that are inappropriate and he gets away with it. So, you know, it adds to that arrogance maybe with people. And yeah, I think there's lots of things that can change, but I think education is a massive one, and I think it's a great opportunity to educate a demographic that there's a strong percentage of them perpetrators or likely perpetrators.
And have you managed to twist the arm of those sporting organisations? Are they moving in your direction?
There's one that is a big one.
Okay.
The IRFU are looking at doing something.
Okay.
Which is massive. And given the details of this case, personally, would be a very... it would mean a lot to me, you know. Whether it'll be well accepted or not, I don't know. But... it's worth a try. That's what I said. Try it and see. If it stops one person being affected by this, is it not worth something? Or, you know, if it starts a conversation with a group of people, or, you know,
yeah,
it's worth something.
What's the next 30, 40 years about then? 50 years? What's the plan?
I don't know. I suppose I want to do a little bit of work on this kind of thing.
Yeah,
and
great.
When the fire is in my belly, I don't know, will it always be there? I think I probably will get to a point where I think, no more. Mm. I need a break. But at the moment, there's definitely fire in the belly. The brain is always ticking over and thinking, well, what else can I do? And what?
I mean, you'd be a remarkable weapon on that, in that sphere. I mean, I can't get over how articulate you are. I can't get over how you've managed to talk about this for the last 40 minutes. You know, it's just extraordinary. And I know I've heard you do a couple of other interviews and you kind of eschew any compliments, but it's remarkable. So, I mean, they would be lucky to have you.
Yeah. They mightn't be lucky to have me on the other side of the table when I'm trying to get them to agree to something.
No,
but
they would.
Hopefully, look, you meet a lot of closed doors, and hopefully that there will be a door open somewhere that we can get a little bit of change. Like I said, if it helps one or two people or prevents one or two people going through the same thing, it'll be worth it.
Well, I guarantee you somebody, and sorry, more than one, we always say if it helps one person, yeah. I guarantee you numerous people will have heard this conversation tonight and will think to themselves, God, have I ever sat down with my 20-year-old and had that awkward as hell conversation?
Yeah. And it is awkward. And I have those conversations now with my parents. And I say things that I can see them thinking, oh my God, I can't believe she's just said that. You know, we could be talking about teenagers accessing porn and I can see my father's face going, oh my God, I can't believe she's saying this. And it's not to be outrageous, but you say the word and then it's done.
Mm.
You know, and they're the conversations that need to be had with, like, those awkward conversations. And you might get the reception from your 20-year-old, I know.
Mm. But do you?
But do they?
Yeah.
Do they know? And also, do you know the fallout of this? If you're not engaging in consensual sex, you can end up going to prison. There's that very real, you know. So if you're not intending on hurting somebody or it's not an intentional non-consensual encounter, you really need to have your wits about you because, you know, you will face prosecution for these things. And I think it's an important thing that we can all conduct ourselves. That's for men and women. You know, we all know the lines.
Yeah. So beyond that, and who knows how long the fire in the belly will burn for, I know early education was what you were doing originally.
Yeah.
What must feel like a lifetime ago. Is that still on the agenda maybe?
Yeah, that's still there. I'm going to do my master's in like child and family health and wellbeing.
Okay. Where do you do that?
In DCU, hopefully.
Are you looking forward to that? Like DCU, college life, normality?
Yeah, I am, I suppose. I've just built a yard at home for the horses with an arena and everything. So that's kind of where my focus is. I can't make money out of that though. So I'm going to have to do something else. But I am looking forward to kind of getting back, using the brain a bit, you know.
Yeah. And as doing interviews like this and the others over the last couple of weeks, are they difficult? Are they traumatizing? Will you have to go and do counselling now and process all of this? Or has it been okay?
No, it's been okay on that front. I find probably afterwards I'm in a little bit like overdrive. The brain is ticking over and I'm thinking, what can I do next? Mm. And where, you know, what about this avenue? Or I hadn't thought about that. Let's look into that or research on that. I find I do a lot of research into statistics and stuff like that. But all in all, I think the process of doing the interviews and stuff like that has been very healing for me. And it has put me in contact with other people that these things have happened to that I had never got to share. Like I never got to speak to anyone before that had been raped or, you know, and now I have gotten to speak to people and they can address the feelings that I've had and they can understand. They say, I feel exactly the same. Or I know exactly how you feel. Or when you said such a thing, it really resonated with me. And it labelled something that I had been feeling for so long. And I get that talking to other people too. I think, finally, somebody who understands why I feel like that.
Is that very helpful?
Yeah. It's less isolating. Okay. I think a lot of the time the feelings you get are very isolating because people mightn't necessarily understand them because they can be a little bit off the wall, you know. Like, I felt very guilty about my attacker going to prison and his family and felt a lot of, I'm worried for them.
Mm.
And somebody else shared a thought with me one day on Instagram and they said, they were talking about reporting their attack and said, but what if I ruin his life?
Mm.
I thought, there's somebody who understands exactly how I feel and I'd say it to other people who might not have experience and they say, why do you care about his life? He doesn't care about you. It's just the thought process. You can't explain it. But when somebody else can say, I feel the same, you go,
yes.
I'm not a freak, you know. There's a reason I think like this. Or it's obviously a common feeling with people that this has happened to. But yeah.
Mm. Our time is coming to a close. Is there anything else that you would like to say or any final thoughts? Or is there something when you're driving home in the car, you'll think, God, I wish I'd said that, made that point?
Probably for victims of sexual violence, engage with your local rape crisis centre. And if you don't have a positive experience with them, engage with another one, because somewhere along the line you'll find a support that will be good for you and that will help. And for people who want to support people of sexual violence or put an end to sexual violence, have a conversation with your friends or your family. Look into maybe a little bit of education. That might be a video on YouTube. Just make sure it's coming from a good source, yes. Not just a random video.
Yes.
And have that conversation and don't shy away from the conversation. You know, we're all adults. I don't like coming on to radio or podcasts and talking about these really intimate things that happen to me, but I'm hoping it helps in the long run. So, you know, don't shy away from these things. Be upfront and have the conversation.
Well, I should say at this point, if you've been affected by the conversation anyway, the Rape Crisis Centre has a 24-hour helpline, which is 1800-777-888. Blondhead Riley, honestly, you're extraordinary. Thank you so much for coming in, and sincerely, all the very best for the future. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Joe.